tuned to Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn. My guest today is Tom Ruwinski. We're talking via Zoom. He's somewhere in the wilds of Massachusetts. And this is the second time that I've interviewed Tom. The last time was over 6 years ago in August 2014. And then, Tom, you talked about the deer and through a conservation lens. Now I'd like to have you talk to our listeners about probably quite a large major transition for you in your life. Can you talk about what it is that you're transitioning from and to?
Sure, Hazel. I've been a professional ecologist and botanist for, I counted them up, 38 years until this year when I received a fellowship from Harvard Forest to really focus on the deer overabundance issue and try to make sense of it in the country. Because it's a terrible problem, but there are a lot of powerful forces at work keeping it a problem. But yeah, my background was trained in wildlife biology, but my early jobs were in natural heritage programs, searching out rare plants and visiting interesting places, actually from Canada to Florida and places in between.
What made those places interesting?
Well, just the element of seeing something spectacular and beautiful or a new plant or some interesting wildlife. So my experiences were, you know, trudging through swamps and climbing mountains and dodging rattlesnakes and fun stuff like that. But, you know, at this point in my career, you asked about the transition. It's part transition, but it's also part continuation because, as you mentioned, when I was with the Forest Service, especially during the early years, I worked extensively on this problem because from a forest health perspective, the deer are laying waste to tens of millions of acres in the Midwest and Northeast, and we have data to support that. And so trying to get that message across, but now I have the luxury of really focusing on it and hopefully helping people understand how we got in this pickle and maybe what it takes to get out of it. During much of this past year when I was still with the Forest Service, most of us worked at home remotely due to COVID. So it's not that much a difference now, except, you know, I'm working on a story, a book, doing this research, trying to wrap my head around this problem. And the problem has reached very high levels. For a while, I was involved with the Staten Island, New York deer situation. And 10 years ago, myself and others gave little presentations there saying that this little herd of 34 deer could increase exponentially. And so now 10 years later, there's 2,000 deer. And the issue, I mean, this is just one example. There's so many of these kinds of stories throughout the country, but this is, you know, pretty high visibility. So Staten Island is called the Borough of Parks because of all the beautiful parkland there. There are 500,000 people who are from Staten Island. When the deer problems start to get really severe in terms of destroying the forest, car collisions, and every kind of mishap a deer could get into, there was support and pressure put on, like Mayor de Blasio and Borough President James Otto, to try to find a solution to it. And they ended up paying for a study that would sterilize almost all the buck deer on Staten Island. And their funding just got extended. So New York City will have spent $6.6 million over the past few years to try to sterilize the males as a, as an approach to reducing the herd gradually.
How do they even do that?
They capture the deer, they anesthetize them with darts, and they give them a quick little vasectomy and give them a recovery drug, and they're on their way. They also put ear tags on them so they can identify them. You have to ask yourself, how many of those 500,000 people understand stewarding the land, understand wildlife dynamics, understand predator-prey relationships? One reason why there's so many deer now there is that there are no wild predators. And I'm not talking just, you know, cougars and wolves, which people mainly think about. But where I live here in Central Mass, there are three other predators that I think are having an impact. That's bobcat, coyote, and black bear. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fawns are most susceptible, but a relatively small bobcat can bring down a mature deer. It's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. So, but on Long Island and Staten Island, you don't have that sort of natural solution of wild predators doing it.
Is it the deer that's, or the forests and the land that's your focus?
I'll just describe it as the deer overabundance issue, mainly because there aren't enough people shining a light on this problem. Because the issue tends to be controversial, I mean, just ask the people at Vassar College what they've done to try to get their cull and all the local opposition to culling the deer at Vassar College. The people who understand the problem too often remain silent or willfully blind because they know it's just too controversial and they just look the other way, which is very convenient, but doesn't solve the problem.
Why is it so controversial? What is it about the human that's protecting the deer? Because that's what it boils down to, right? The human, right, instead of being a predator, is a protector.
Yeah, I would compare it with other forest health pests that are out there, like the Asian longhorn beetle or the emerald ash borer, or maybe some of these emerging diseases like beech disease. 100% of the public are against those things, right? Have you heard anyone trying to save emerald ash borers? For agencies, it's much easier to focus all their money and to give money to address those issues, which carry absolutely no or very little political risk. Now, contrast that to a deer population in town. I mean, this animal is incredibly beautiful, graceful, charismatic. It has values in terms of watchable wildlife, but it also has a utilitarian value. I mean, venison is highly nutritious, and in much of the country, people very much look forward to hunting season to stock their freezers and all that. So if you're talking about reducing deer herds to a level that the forest can survive, because I think ultimately that's something we should all be able to agree on. If nature is healthy, then we're healthy and the animals are healthy. But when you start getting into this deer issue, which is so politically charged, you're going to have stakeholder groups protesting from every different angle. It's an amazing business also. The author Al Cambrone out in the Midwest called it America's Deer Industrial Complex. Because about each year, about $6 billion is spent on deer hunting and deer hunting related business and activities like motel rooms and restaurants and ammunition. Oh. You'd also get pushback from, well, you know, Eisenhower came up with that military industrial complex thing, right? Mm-hmm. But I think later he added something to it, or somebody did, that you have to add government into there too. So with the deer, I see it as America's Deer Industrial Agency Complex, because these wildlife agencies take care of this commonly held resource. They receive a good percentage of their funding through hunting licenses. And that constituency has been very strong and has done wonderful things. Your license fees have protected thousands of land, acres of land. The hunters tend to squawk if there are proposals to reduce them to certain levels.
But isn't this also a misunderstanding or a refusal to accept science?
That's huge. If you just come to the table spouting scientific facts, that won't do the trick.
But in terms of self-interest, the homeowner, one of the stakeholders in all of this is the homeowner. People like me, they see it with their own eyes, that their family members or their pets get sick from tick bites, and or the forests around their home are deteriorating. I mean, they see that, and the car wrecks. So in terms of self-interest, as a psychologist, I've sort of given up trying to understand this, but an economist would say you're not acting in accord with your own self-interest by allowing the deer to proliferate.
To an ecologist, you know, if trees stop reproducing, then that's it. You don't have a sustainable forest and everything that goes with it. And all the values that forests provide, like purifying groundwater, moderating the climate, the recreational aspects that during COVID so many people are really flocking to, it's sort of a blessing and a curse, Hazel. I mentioned all the travel I do. And all the deer ravaged forests I've seen and all the good people I've met who are trying to make a difference. But, you know, it starts at the local level. There'll be meetings and maybe a town supervisor will get the message and appeal to a state assembly person who brings it to the Natural Resource Committee, who rejects it because the hunting lobby is so strong. And the poor biologists stuck in the middle, they're constrained by the laws on the book. You know, they'd say, okay, Hazel, Natituck has this deer problem, but we can't let you do X, Y, and Z because there's old laws on the book that says you can't shoot a suppressed rifle from a vehicle, for instance, which comes in real handy at night when they're doing this kind of culling. And you know, ultimately, you know, we want to be good stewards of nature. We want to leave the legacy that we inherited, you know, and not in this horrible state that we see. You know, the forests become choked with weeds and they're tick infested. And if people aren't going into the woods or if they're afraid of them, that doesn't bode well for people then going out and trying to protect them. And you protect what you love, right? So if
you're scared of going into the woods and you're not going to go in there because it's like a danger zone, it's not your beloved environment. So you've identified the problem, and it's the same problem that you talked about 6 years ago. And you have been carrying the problem with you all these years. And now you're moving into another part of your own life, but you're taking the problem with you, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
So tell our listeners, how will it be different now?
I was quite humbled to get this fellowship, the Bullard Fellowship in Forest Research. And
it's from Harvard University?
It is. Harvard Forest is their research facility out in rural Petersham, Massachusetts. And it looks like a quaint little place, but some of the world's top researchers are there doing some really impressive work on big questions like climate change and chemical composition changes in forests. And each year when these fellowships are awarded, it brings fresh thinking and new blood into the organization. So I'm really enjoying that, you know, being in the first time sort of in an academic situation. But, you know, my work would be try to bring this problem home to the American people in a way that they can understand it and gear the story towards high school students or young college students who I think need to understand the complexities of this. They're so environmentally aware. Someone needs to explain to them so they can rally around it and be our future.
And you're proposing basically to do this through your book.
You know, in writing about white-tailed deer, it's kind of funny because this is the most studied wild animal in the world. And there's umpteen million books that have been written about it and also technical reports and all that stuff. So there's so much to draw upon. But, you know, what I think hasn't been done is to try to connect to the average people and describe this in simple terms and put forward, you know, either or situations. You don't want the deer to be hunted or culled. How do you feel about 50 of them getting killed by cars every year? And the staunch people will then come up with a counter argument saying that people don't obey speed limits. That's why there's so many roadkill deer.
So you know what counter arguments to anticipate because you've heard them all these years that you've been working.
You know, I want to tell people's stories. You know, the compelling stories that I have heard and the really great heroes of conservation, you know, this will be their platform to tell their story and all they went through. Because there are thousands of communities in the country grappling with this issue. And we're up against a very powerful foe. This white-tailed deer is amazingly smart and prolific and can hide. We've almost met our match. You know, my awe of these animals is simply amazing.
I'm intrigued by this idea that you have in your mind a millennial person, somebody who's maybe leaving school and leaving college, those years of a young person's life. And you think that that's a good time to be talking to them about this.
Yeah.
And you have a son who I know is probably your ideal customer, let's say.
I'm thinking back to, you know, my own personal experience when I was younger. If you were to ask people, what were some of the influential books that changed history.
Botanist and conservationist Tom Rewinski is talking to me about the book he'll be writing on the challenges of advocating deer management. This is Tidings on WPKN Radio.
You know, number one would be Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. Mm-hmm. And she was up against incredibly powerful forces with the chemical companies in cahoots with government spraying DDT and other toxins, with birds dying everywhere. And those of us with wildlife biology training, we had to read Aldo Leopold's works, including a Sand County Almanac. Mm-hmm. And that's a book that really resonated with lots of young people. So, you know, that's my very lofty ambition, is to tell this story and make people understand, because you can't solve a problem unless you understand all the complexities, and human nature is such a huge part of it. I have seen adults come around and totally change. You may be one yourself. I think
I am. I'm a convert.
Yeah, that hunters were seen as, you know, marauding oafs in the woods, killing animals, but it's a lot more different than that. And you mentioned my son. Mm-hmm. He's living the life of Riley now. He got a fisheries degree at ESF out in Syracuse, and now he's working at a federal fish lab. And he knows this now that he's older and mature. He knows that I equipped him with some of the essentials of, you know, country living. And I'm not unique in being a country boy and, you know, skinning bucks and catching fish and all this stuff. So I think Pete has those skills. So I feel really proud and good about that.
Thinking about all the conversations we've had, it's about conservation.
One word that should resonate, the word is stewardship. Mm. You know, that even goes back to biblical teachings, where we are to be good stewards of, you know, God's creatures and the land. So there's some real meat to that term when you talk about stewards. And I mentioned Aldo Leopold, and one of his quotes was, "A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise." Mm. So in that phrase, he talked about what's right and what's wrong. That comes into morality and ethics. So that is actually called Leopold's land ethic, that I think can be a unifying principle.
But it seems to me we're all hinging our hopes for the future on this generation, but they need to be studied too. Now, you understand your son, and you've done obviously a great job with him. And here I'm being very bold, Tom, because I so much support what you're trying to do. Now, in some way, your 30 or more years in all of this and the number of people and agencies that you have had contact with and controversy with, in a sense, if you don't mind me saying so, you have not succeeded with them in persuading them.
I have a few professional colleagues and friends who are wildlife biologists, and they know the history of people who've tried to get a handle on this problem, which has been described as the worst mistake in the history of wildlife management, you know, from one perspective. And I would be in that camp, whereas I am also a deer hunter. I've spent a lot of time with deer hunters, and deer hunting is almost the center of their lives out in the country. It's a tradition. You know, schools close in Pennsylvania on opening day. Mm-hmm. Hunters have never had it so good, and I know that. So they have to be a little more understanding that they have a role to play. You know, if they don't do it, then maybe some sharpshooters will come in, and they don't want that to happen. You know, one example of hunter attitudes, I'm for deer herd reduction everywhere except where my son and I hunt. Mm. So hunters have a role, and hunters are declining. We're getting old, getting slow.
And the children of hunters are not interested in perpetuating the tradition?
Yeah, to a large extent.
So in a way, it's good for the deer that there's fewer hunters.
When you say good for the deer, that has to be qualified, because in high population numbers, they're always hungry because they've eaten most of the forage. They have to come into town where they'll eat your hostas, and they have to cross roads where they get smashed by cars. And to me, that's one of the saddest things you know, in New York State, the estimate is about 60,000 deer killed by cars each year.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, the hunters harvest about 200,000. So that's a very large percentage of these beautiful animals that are mostly just wasted. You know, it's such a tragedy. You know, I've found them crippled and wounded, and I've had to put them out of their misery, which is a very intense operation. But I think
another platitude, I suppose, is less is more.
The succinct way I would put that is healthy forests create healthy deer and healthy people.
Mm.
Healthy people physically and the reduced Lyme disease risk, perhaps. Healthier in terms of their emotional well-being, feeling safe in forests again, and you know, just that spiritual connection is there in nature's full glory, the flowers and the pollinators and the whole web of life there.
I'm trying to find a way of asking you this question. You have this thing, it's so present in your mind, it's your life's work, but you continue to be optimistic that you can continue to make a difference.
The reason why is that I know I'm not alone. Mm. There are really good people out there who I've met, and I really feel for them, and I want to help them the best way I can, maybe through this little book. But, you know, I do it for them, the homeowner who grew up next to Tall Pines Town Sanctuary in your hometown of Southold, New York, was just the kind of depression is palpable. You know, I feel it, and she feels it too. Ellen Wexler is her name. The great crusader, you probably know her.
Yeah, of course.
You know, unlike a lot of these other tree health problems of invasive bugs and diseases, this deer problem, which is so much larger than those because it affects the whole ecosystem, it's solvable. Yeah. There's a known solution to this problem. And that in itself is sort of eye-popping. The deer issue is solvable. It's a known solution. And it just requires the community and the people to embark on a management program to be stewards of the land and serve as that predator that is missing from the ecosystem. So the deer reproduce like crazy when there's no predation. They evolved with wolves and cougars and saber-toothed tigers and cave bears and all that kind of stuff. You know, our place in nature, if communities and groups understand that, yes, you know, we evolved as predators, we understand the dynamics of ecosystems, that on a local level, I think we have to, you know, see our place in nature, that we have a role. We just can't be voyeuristic and go to a forest as, you know, observers of birds and plants and then just go home. I think we have to be involved.
But in some way, we don't know that the solution is because we've not been able to enact it, implement the solution. So there's a missing ingredient. There is an argument that has not been made, an irrefutable argument. You have to surrender. And I don't know what that argument is. We actually are the deer's predator, but we don't know how to be predators. We turn down the opportunity to be predators.
And we outsource it to, you know, factory slaughterhouses and all that.
I have a few more questions I'd like to ask you. I wonder if there's anything that you'll miss from, you know, in your old job.
I guess the most dramatic change is the freedom I have now to work, to have an interview with you, for instance. I think in my previous job, I wouldn't have been allowed to because the deer issue is too controversial. And a lot of my deer work was cut short or cut back because of the controversy involved.
Really?
I mean, it doesn't take much to be silenced in an agency. And so without having layer and layer of supervisors, you know, being overly timid and just flat being afraid of the deer issue, I have this freedom now. I can go where I want, speak with whom I want, and write what I want, pretty much.
As a conservationist, what have you learned that you didn't know before?
The first thing that pops into my mind is how much I still need to learn about human nature and what is effective and what resonates with people and how do we change opinions and gain support for these types of deer management and ecosystem management that we know can have a positive effect. Now, you mentioned earlier that there haven't been many success stories
Yeah, I hope I didn't offend you when I said that.
No, that's very true.
But Tom, let me ask you another, this is probably a little bit strange question, but if Aldo Leopold was alive today, is there anything you would tell him that you know now that maybe he didn't know?
Very good question.
He's like, a god to you all.
Yeah, he's like our god. So it's hard to say, what would I tell God to improve upon?
No, that he just didn't know because he didn't have the same, he didn't live long enough as long as you've been living.
I don't know if Aldo could possibly have imagined what this animal is capable of doing in terms of moving into suburban sprawl. So the animal really surprises us, its tenacity.
Mm. Was he that interested in the deer, in the white-tailed deer?
Extremely so. He sat on a state committee and helped push antlerless season in Wisconsin in 1943, but there was such a backlash that it didn't last long.
Mm.
And
but in the meantime, I'm curious about one thing, Tom. How will you be writing this book? Are you somebody like who keeps everything on index cards or notebooks, or do you write by hand? I'm just curious what your work methodology is going to be for this book.
Organizing thoughts and also trying to set up interviews with people where I can get some firsthand updates of some of these critical situations. You know, I'll contact some of these people who have been really involved in their local issues, who I see as heroes and deserve to be mentioned as such.
Well, I think it's wonderful. I'm really happy that we had this conversation. I was so happy when I heard that you've got this fellowship at such an illustrious institution.
It was very humbling to receive this. And at the same time, I feel a responsibility to do right by all these good people out there and just try to help in some way. I mean, writing scientific papers or giving talks, yeah, that helps maybe a little bit. But I think we need to set the bar a little higher and try to reach, like I said, the millennials and other young people who do have this innate fascination with animal life and hunting. I mean, so easy. A young child, you can teach the fish and they're hooked for life pretty much. Mm-hmm. I try to stay positive. I keep my rose-colored glasses on. You know, growing up, we were pretty much modern-day hunter-gatherers, and it just stayed with us. And there's some good survival lessons there. And, you know, for me, I live through every season. You know, it starts at maple syrup season, moves to fiddlehead season, to work on the garden and dig up the worms and catch some fish. The only thing I don't like is mowing the grass. One of my joys, especially being sequestered here, is I can work by the old Glenwood wood cook stove. Mm. Which is almost like a person. You have to feed it every hour, but yet it cooks your food and heats your house and dries your socks.
Mm.
So, you know, stockpiling wood is a real pleasure. It's good exercise that I get.
Well, one day I want to have some of your gatherings. Not your hunting so much, but your gatherings.
When this is over, I'll hop on the ferry. And
you'll bring some goodies over.
Always. Great.
Thank you, Tom. We finally did it, and I'm really happy. Tom Rowinski talking to me from Central Mass. Thank you, Tom. I look forward to just keeping in touch with everything that you're doing.
Great.
You've been listening to botanist and conservationist Tom Rowinski talking about his next steps in a career spent advocating deer management. You can find Tidings right here on the second Wednesday of the month, and anytime at all as podcasts on hazelkahn.com. Tidings programs are produced by Tony Ernst.